Diva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to be hearing from an attorney turned author talking about his latest novel, which is called The Middleman, which takes a look at a facet of the pharmaceutical industry that most of us are not very much aware of, the so-called middlemen, who actually do quite a lot to drive up the price of our pharmaceutical medication. And in some ways that once in a while are a bit shady, and that's especially the case in this particular novel. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. First, though, for part one of today's program, I'm delighted to welcome back to the program Brian Gill from the University of Wisconsin Parkside to talk about a production which he has been directing, leading, guiding to its opening night, which is tonight. And it's none other than one of Shakespeare's most famous tragedies, Macbeth. There are performances this weekend and the following weekend on the main stage of the Rita. And I'm excited to speak with Brian Gill about this play, about the challenges involved in doing Shakespeare, and this particular play, which is, of course, exceptionally powerful and around which there is a very special sort of mystique. Brian Gill, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Good to see you.
I know we don't need to dwell on this, but I think it would be interesting for our listeners to know just how much has been on your plate as of late. You are, I believe, if I remember correctly right now, the acting chair of the theater department.
Yes, the interim chair. Yes,
right,
indeed.
And you've had all kinds of things to deal with on top of this little play called Macbeth.
Yeah, just that's a little skit, you know.
Right. So what has it been like over the last weeks and months to be having an especially full plate?
You know, it's certainly made me appreciate the time in the rehearsal room and on the stage with all the student actors and my colleagues, my design colleagues. It's definitely brought my appreciation and gratitude for that particular joy to the forefront. You know, when dealing with all the chair responsibilities and combined with teaching and all those other kind of things.
Sure, yes. Yeah, I'm sure those chair responsibilities are not why you went into the theater in the
first place. Curiously, no.
All right, so let's get to Shakespeare's Macbeth, and there is a whole lot to talk about in terms of this amazing play. First of all, in general, how much does Shakespeare tend to figure in the theatrical offerings at the University of Wisconsin Parkside? Is there always Shakespeare each and every season?
It's been the every other year for quite some time. I think it's important training for our student actors. I think it's great training for our student designers. I'm a Shakespeare nerd, so you know, one of my life's missions is to demystify the works and make them accessible, and help people understand that Shakespeare was writing the most modern plays for his time, arguably, in Western theater. He was literally creating the English language as he was going. So this idea that they're some other kind of language, or that they're an archaic form of English, is something I'm constantly railing against.
I can understand that. Did you have any role in the selection of Macbeth specifically to occupy this place in this season?
Yeah, I did. My colleagues and I, you know, we spend a good amount of time figuring out each season, and we knew that a Shakespeare was coming up, and so I floated it. I said, you know, it's been quite some time since that shadowy figure has appeared on our stage, and I'd love to take a crack at it.
Sure.
Everyone was really excited about it.
So if we look back over, let's say, the last 30 years at roughly, I would guess, 15 or 16 Shakespeare plays that have been done, do you collectively try to sort of survey them all? I mean, not that every single one of them is a towering masterpiece, but most of what he wrote had something going for it, obviously. But I mean, what kinds of things do you think about in terms of this year we do Macbeth, next year we do Hamlet, next year we right. do Romeo and Juliet. How do those kind of choices get made, generally speaking?
Well, partly depending on what other shows we're looking at. I mean, obviously, as a producing theater company, we want to make sure that there's going to be an interest. You know, I don't know if I had said, let's do Timon of Athens, I think my colleagues probably would have just stared at me blankly. You know, the great thing about Macbeth is that everybody knows of it, even if they don't realize they know of it. Mm. Everybody quotes it, even if they don't realize they're quoting it. And it's just, you know, it's the shortest of the plays. It's really just a kind of a I was telling the students at rehearsal the other night, they were lingering a little too long at times, and I said, you know, this is a bullet train to hell. There is no pausing in this play. It's just, you know, it is just fast-paced, and by design. I mean, Shakespeare wrote it for the new monarch, James the First, whose attention span supposedly was not the greatest. And so he was pandering to the new monarch, who was obsessed with witchcraft and didn't like to sit for too long. You know, so it's but I mean, all the witchcraft, all the sword fights, all the, you know, it's the opportunities for having a lot of fun with it, and the audience having a lot of fun with it are great. So yeah, it was a good choice.
Absolutely. And my sense of it is there is not much that one would think of as extraneous. I mean, there is a really focused intensity. And one has very little sense of you're kind of waiting for this to be done, so the action resumes. It's
absolutely, yeah. It's a reactionary play. You know, a bad decision is made, and then they spend the next, you know, 2 hours roughly, trying to then lurch from one thing to the next. You know,
right.
It is. It's a very, very quick-paced play.
We're speaking with Brian Gill from the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Tonight, their production of Shakespeare's Macbeth opens. I want to talk for a moment about the connection to real history, because, of course, many Shakespeare plays are complete fiction, if you will, mm-hmm. But not Macbeth, although Macbeth is certainly also not pure unadulterated history,
right?
But certainly based, at least to some extent, on someone who actually lived. Tell us about the real person in history upon whom Shakespeare draws in formulating his play Macbeth.
Yeah, the kind of the great irony is that historically, it was Duncan who was the tyrant and the horrible king. And in Shakespeare's play, Duncan is the kind of, oftentimes he's portrayed as you know, a monarch kind of towards the end of his life, and he's, you know, just a very nice and likable and quiet,
and
sometimes older guy.
And
right?
Ineffective in some respects.
Yeah,
respect,
yeah,
probably,
that yeah. everybody likes and everybody's fine with. But historically, Duncan apparently was a horrible person, and Macbeth was the good guy. And so Shakespeare took that idea and turned it on its head, of this idea of this not particularly well-known clan chieftain and warlord who miraculously saves the day. The Scots are at war with, in the play, the Scots are at war with Norway, and one of the clan chiefs changes sides, and MacDonald betrays the king, and Macbeth and Banquo are able to turn what was becoming a drubbing into a great victory, which then takes Macbeth into the spotlight, you know, the eye of the king, and then Lady Macbeth gets ambitious.
She sure does, and we'll get to that in just a moment. I'm just curious, since you're a Shakespeare nerd, I'm assuming you can answer this question, how often are we talking about Shakespeare plays that draw, at least to a limited extent, from actual history? I mean, is that common, or is that relatively rare in terms of all of Shakespeare's plays?
Now, see, you're unleashing my nerd, my Shakespeare nerd, so be careful. When the Shakespeare's Folio was published, the plays were divided into three categories that didn't exist up to that point. So you've got the comedies, you've got the tragedies, you have the histories. And the histories, I mean, that's where you've got, you know, Richard II and Henry IV, 1 and 2, and Henry V, and the Henry VIs, and Richard III, and Julius Caesar. So, you know, he would take these stories and kind of ground them in a historical time, and then just kind of go wild with, with it was all about the storytelling and, you know, and truncating things. I mean, Richard III did not have a crooked back. He was not he did not have any kind of physical deformities at all. But, you know, Shakespeare wanted to make him a grotesque villain of all you know, across the board. So he played a lot. He used historical references. But he also was, you know, he knew what he needed to do to sell tickets.
Right. So he takes liberties.
Absolutely.
And so on.
Absolutely.
Interesting. As I read up a little bit about Macbeth, mention was made of the current king, James, you said?
Mm-hmm.
And how whatever I read said something to the effect that of all of Shakespeare's plays written at this time, Macbeth is probably the one in which there were the most connections, whether clear or unclear, with the current king, as though Macbeth was, in a sense, a bit of a commentary on either how this James was ruling or maybe how Shakespeare thought James should rule. Or I'm not sure exactly what was meant by that, but what would you make of a statement like that about Macbeth being having some real connection to the current king, aside from the matter of Shakespeare wanting it to be entertaining for him?
You know, William Shakespeare was a very savvy businessman. And the Globe Theater made money. You know, I mean, he was in it for the money. This is the good old days when you could make a lot of money in theater. But so the new king came into power, and he wanted that royal backing. You know, they were a company called the Chamberlain's Men, the Lord Chamberlain's Men. But he wanted them to be the king's men. And so this was a really good opportunity to write a play, really almost pandering to the new king, right? James was obsessed with witchcraft. He wrote a book called Demonology. So, you know, Shakespeare thought, okay, well, if I write this short play that's all about witchcraft and things that go bump in the night, and then I have this character named Banquo that I directly link to James the First, because in a vision, Macbeth sees that Banquo is going to be the root of the next monarchy. And you know, so he ties that into flattering the king. You know, you are the king now, and your heirs will be the king forever, kind of a thing. Now, the great irony is that James I hated the play, found it very disturbing, you know, having survived a bunch of assassination attempts as a child. The last thing he wanted to do was see a whole bunch of blood and knives and daggers.
Wow.
So it wasn't produced for a very long time after it was released.
And it is a violent play.
It's a very violent play, yeah.
Here's another question for a Shakespeare nerd. So if I remember correctly, the historical Macbeth, I think, is maybe the 11th century. Does that sound right?
That sounds right, yeah.
So we're talking about at least the historic Macbeth, something that had happened, so what is that, 450 years earlier or something like that, 450, 500 years earlier. Would the people going to see Macbeth, would they have sensed that? I mean, is this set in a time earlier than Shakespeare, or are we talking about plays in which the historical setting, the time frame, didn't particularly matter in the way that it seems to really matter a lot nowadays?
Right. Well, you know, one of the fascinating things about this kind of theater is that in Shakespeare's time, there were no sets. And costumes were a different kind of thing. You know, they had costumes, but they weren't costumes the way that we think of costumes. Okay. So it was very much the storytelling was in the language. It was, you know, the actor's job was and still is to engage in the language in such a way that we're painting the pictures, right? We're giving the audience the tools they need to use their imaginations. So there wasn't necessarily, you know, they talk a lot about, well, now we're in this part of Scotland, now we're in that part of Scotland, but nobody would be wearing kilts or would be dressed historically accurately or, you know, or any of that kind of stuff. It was just all about, You know, every scene starts with a character either being introduced by name or they say, here we are in Inverness.
and the audience goes,
okay, cool, we're in Inverness.
There you go. Okay. Yep. So very little in the way of visual trappings would have set this in a particular time or place.
Right.
And that just kind of underscores the universality of so much of what Shakespeare wrote or the way in which it tends to be received. It's about universal themes. It's not about this year, this time, this place.
Right. Yeah, and it's one of the reasons that you see so many different concepts with Shakespeare's plays. That you know, you see one production that's set, you know, in a post-apocalyptic world, and another production is set in the corporate world, and the next production is, you know, set in 19th century Scotland
or
you know.
Old West or on
exactly.
the moon or
yeah.
whatever.
You can just kind of go crazy with it.
Wow. We're speaking with Brian Gill about the production of Shakespeare's Macbeth that he is directing at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. It opens this weekend. Performances run for the next two weekends on the main stage of the Rita. We've danced around something of the story of Macbeth, but maybe we should just stop for a moment and give you a chance to summarize the main plot line of Macbeth. Then we'll dig into a few specifics.
Sure. So clan chieftain Macbeth rises through the ranks. He saves the day along with his friend and fellow chieftain Banquo during a massive battle with the Norwegians, and he gets the attention of the king, and his wife decides that they need to be the new royal family. So she plants the seed in Macbeth's mind that they need to kill Duncan, the king. Make it look like, you know, it was an assassination from not them. But
that's right. They plant the murder weapons on the servants.
These two poor schlubs she gets them drunk. They pass out. Macbeth kills the king, and they frame these two guys, who he then kills to tie up all the loose ends.
Right. So it's that Macbeth tastes this victory, and his wife realizes, oh my gosh, we can ride this even higher. I mean,
right.
We can take this success
and
give you what you really deserve, which is the throne.
Right, and it's because it's Shakespeare. The spark that ignites this whole thing is on the way home from the battle. Macbeth and Banquo come across the weird sisters. So these wise women, these witches, who prophesy. And he writes to Lady Macbeth that, you know, I came across these strange women who said I was going to be king. And Lady Macbeth says, this is a great idea. We will make that happen.
Mm.
And they may or may not regret their choices.
Right. Yes. Yeah, let's just say it does not go terribly well for Macbeth nor Lady Macbeth. I want to give you a chance to talk about the kind of the mystique that surrounds the play Macbeth, and the fact that it is often referred to as the Scottish tragedy rather than by name. And I suspect a fair number of our listeners have maybe heard something about that. I've certainly heard of that, but I don't know anything about why that is the case. Is there a particular reason why this sort of myth about Macbeth has sprung up?
Yeah, there's a tradition that says that this is a cursed play, that this play is very bad luck. You never say the name of the play unless you are working on the play, unless you are rehearsing or performing the play.
So you're okay, but I'm in trouble. Right. Of course, I'm working on PR.
Right,
so,
you're okay outside
all right.
of the theater.
Okay,
but, if
all
you're
right.
in the theater and you say it, then you're in trouble.
Ah, okay.
So the two possible stories are that William Shakespeare included in the play, because there are scenes with the witches where they are spellcasting and conjuring, that he included actual spells, actual black magic, because, of course, in Shakespeare's time, witches were alive and well and living all over the place, and witchcraft was an accepted and feared reality. Hmm. So the one thought is that he somehow got a hold of a book of spells or managed to weave these spells into the play so that when these actors start speaking these words, they start conjuring.
Mm.
And that opens the play up for and the production up for a lot of bad luck. And then the other story that I've heard is that when this play was performed, there were witches in the audience, as there would have been, and they were not particularly pleased with how they were being represented, and so they cursed the play. But the play itself has a very long history of accidents and murders and deaths and things going wrong, and I always tread very lightly.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah,
I should add, and I don't know if you've ever heard this story, but I know you're aware that Giuseppe Verdi transformed the play into a quite noteworthy opera, really his first international success, and a very powerful retelling of the story. And tragically, at the Metropolitan Opera, this is many, many years ago, during a Saturday broadcast of Macbeth, during one of the intermissions, an elderly man leapt to his death off of one of the upper balconies in the Met. And I remember vividly listening to this radio broadcast, and you could tell that Peter Allen, the host, was tap dancing and lengthening, and they went back and redid more of the opera quiz, and he came back and so on. At one point, he said there's been an emergency in the opera house, and you know, but beyond that, did not elaborate at all. And then ultimately made the announcement that, unfortunately, the performance cannot continue. And we're all at home wondering what in the world, and this is before the internet, so it's not even like we could Google and see. It was now. I remember then the evening news that this story then was carried, that unfortunately this troubled elderly man actually had apparently committed suicide during this performance of Verdi's Macbeth. But that was one of the first times. I've never had been much of a scholar of Shakespeare, certainly, and I really didn't even know anything about what we've just been talking about until stories were written about this tragedy at the Metropolitan Opera, and for certain people, it was just like underscored that sense of this being a cursed work, even the operatic version of it by Verdi.
Yeah, I mean, murders, accidents, the largest riot, I think the most deadly riot of the time in the late 1800s, the Astor Place riot. Was the basis of the riot was who was the better actor playing Macbeth?
Wow.
Edwin Forrest or MacReady. You know, and 200 people were injured because the local militia had to come out and they opened fire on the crowd. I mean, it's just, you know, it runs the gamut. It has a very dark and violent production history.
Wow. Well, I trust things have been going a little smoother with Parkside production. Not to make light of anybody's misery or sorrow,
find
but
find some wood to knock on.
Right.
Yeah, so far, so good.
Right. Talk for a moment about the challenge that Shakespeare represents to students, particularly students who might be doing Shakespeare for the very first time. You yourself said that that's one of the reasons why it figures fairly prominently in the seasons that get planned at UW-Parkside, and of course, not just at Parkside, but In most colleges and universities, one encounters Shakespeare fairly often. But what are the challenges, especially those beyond the obvious, for you as the director guiding these young students?
Right. Shakespeare writes a kind of theater that is incredibly physical. There's a muscularity to it. So it's not a case of the characters have a good think and figure out the problem and then explain it. You know, these are, when Shakespeare is done well, the audience is watching these incredibly intelligent people problem solve in real time. And the thing I always say to the actors is everything has to be online, meaning the action, Shakespeare himself says in Hamlet, right? Suit the word to the action, the action to the word. It has to link up. So nobody wants to see someone talk about something and then do the thing. They want to see them doing the thing while they are explaining why they're doing the thing.
Right.
And that's one that it takes a while for beginning actors in Shakespeare to figure out. Everybody wants to really pause and really show that they're thinking hard and things like that, and it tanks the energy. It becomes very plodding. you know, Shakespeare is it's energetic. There's an aggressiveness to the language. Mm. There's nothing lazy about it. And unfortunately, most people's introduction to Shakespeare is either reading it, which it was never intended for at all. I think if someone had said to Shakespeare, "Hey, we're gonna publish your plays in a collected works," he would have said, "Why on earth would you do that? Who's gonna read it?" You
know, right,
I mean,
right.
The people who come to see the play can't read. Why would we do that? Mm. Their first experience is dull and confusing. So I'm always trying to explain that, you know, we still use 80-some-odd% of the exact same words as Elizabethan and Jacobean people were using.
Right.
The thoughts have to be clear. There's a technical side of it, right? Are we lifting the active words? Mm. Are we hitting the verse too hard so it sounds like Dr. Seuss instead of real language? You know, I'm constantly on the soapbox of, these were the most modern plays in Western theater ever. And wow. I say that because he was literally inventing words while he was writing these plays that his audience, the majority couldn't read and write anyway, somehow managed to follow what was going on. And when the flag was flying at the Globe, meaning they were performing, they were selling out. Mm. And the original Globe held 3,000 people.
Wow.
So, you know, this was big business, and this was massive entertainment.
Yeah, so he was doing something right.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, now we've kind of been programmed to think of it as inaccessible and,
right.
you know,
difficult.
Yeah, for the intellectuals or, you know, and things like that. And it's not. I mean, he was writing. He truly was writing for everybody.
So your particular production, are you playing around with time and place? I mean, are we on the moon or at the bottom of the ocean or anything? Or is this, in a sense, relatively close to what Shakespeare himself would have envisioned?
We are in the early 1970s.
Oh.
It is very punk. So lots of studded leather. The designs are based on Vivian Westwood's work. And we're having a ball. It lends itself really well to the play. Lots of plaid pants and shirts and leather and the necessary music is being used to see the concept through.
Wow!
We're having a ridiculous amount of fun. So still swords, still lots of witchcraft. I took some of the conjuring scenes from a contemporary of Shakespeare, Thomas Middleton, who wrote a play called The Witch, and kind of doubled down on the black magic and the witchcraft. There's an argument that Middleton wrote a scene of Macbeth.
Ah, interesting.
Because these playwrights worked a lot together.
Okay.
So I thought, all right, well, I'm going to go with that, I'm going to borrow some more.
Wow. So. Well, now I'm even more intrigued. So Shakespeare's Macbeth performed this weekend and the next on the main stage of the Rita at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. We direct people to the website uwp.edu. There's a nice link to theater and arts where you can get all the information you need to get tickets for Macbeth. Brian Gill, thank you so much for being here. It was great to talk with you.
Good to see
Best
you,
wishes to you and all of your cast and crew for Macbeth. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is part two of today's program. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a new novel, a thriller, actually, a legal thriller called The Middleman. And the author of the book is Mike Papantonio, who is an attorney. He is a senior partner with Levin Papantonio, which is one of America's largest plaintiff law firms. And he has, in his real-life work as an attorney, dealt with the pharmaceutical industry, and in particular, the inflation of certain pharmaceutical products, and has worked tirelessly on behalf of various plaintiffs, perhaps most notably His firm was the first that filed a lawsuit around inflated insulin prices. One of the reasons we have the pharmaceutical prices that we do is because of the presence of pharmacy benefit managers, a so-called middleman, who work between drug manufacturers and insurance companies. And often it is through their engineering that we see some of the prices that we do. And so Mike Papantonio decided that he would craft a legal thriller around this particular issue. In the same way that he has tackled other issues in other works of fiction before this, called such as Law and Disorder, Law and Vengeance, Law and Addiction, Inhuman Trafficking, and Suspicious Activity. This latest novel, again published by Arcade, is The Middleman, a legal thriller. And Mike Papantonio, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you for the invitation.
Since this is your first visit to the morning show, I wonder if we could just hear first briefly on what drew you into the field of law in the first place. If I remember correctly, you were actually a journalism major in college. Am I right about that?
I sure was. I had the opportunity to meet probably one of the best trial while I was in journalism school. I met the lawyer regarded as one of the top five trial lawyers in America. And after spending a little bit of time with him, I concluded it's probably something I ought to do. And I figured I could go to law school and handle some important cases and write at the same time. So I think what attracted me is if my career has been, you know, we launched the tobacco case, the national tobacco case, right here at my law firm. We launched the opioid case, the human trafficking case, the PFAS case. Those were the types of things I was interested in. I wanted to do some things that meant something socially. And so I was able to do both. As a journalist, sometimes you can write about it, but you're limited on what you can do about it. So I figured, let me put those two elements together and let me try to have an impact, at least to some degree. And I think certainly the tobacco case that we filed had a huge national impact. The opioid case, we kept 150 people a day from dying, you know, continuously. So those things mattered to me. So the PBM case that we're talking about here, Greg, is a case that it's so – the industry is so upside down that I was able to use a mobster schematic, how a mobster organization would operate, and implant that into the PBM process, and it fit perfectly. Because what it is basically a mobster entity to a large degree. They engage in extortion. Now, the extortion doesn't look like extortion, and it's become such a norm that we don't call it extortion. But let me explain what I'm talking about. A pill, any type of pharmaceutical, can't even be sold in a pharmacy if this PBM doesn't give it the right to be sold. In other words, if there's five pills out there and they all do the same thing, the PBM makes the selection of which pill is going to be put on a list that can be covered by insurance coverage. And so if they don't play ball with the pharmaceutical, the PBM doesn't say, look, pharmaceutical company, if you don't give us kickbacks, we're not going to put your product on this list. And it's exactly what happens every day. And it's why our pharmaceuticals are as high as 2 to 3,000% markups. So it's a pretty ugly process.
Can you explain how such a process is in place? And is this a case where something where a harm has been sort of inadvertently created? I mean, is this something that in no way was foreseen? I mean, how did we get to this state of affairs?
Greg, it was clearly foreseeable. You had this an industry where they made a deal. The manufacturers and the pharmacies put this organization in the middle. That's where that term middleman comes from. They put it in the middle, and they understood that middle was going to control access to pharmacy elements. It was going to control costs. It was going to control every aspect of how the pharmaceutical industry worked. Now, that was done with an understanding that the insurance company was going to play ball with that. So all of a sudden, you had this thing that it's not, there's no regulation. This isn't like a typical regulatory organization. This isn't like the FDA or the EPA. This was a industry-created element. And since they have been in that process of what they do, they have added 40 to 50% cost to everything that's sold in this country. There's nobody looking over their shoulder. It's a $300 billion a year industry. We haven't looked at it because they've spread around so much money. They've given so much money to politicians and regulators and you name it. And so the real irony to it is the first time I've even heard an administration talk about it was 4 weeks ago, when at last somebody in the White House or in regulatory says, what is this thing and why are we allowing it to happen? Because there's no other country that has this. This is unique to this country. And when I say kickbacks, they're kickbacks that attach themselves to the PBM saying, we're going to pick your pill to be sold on the market. But there's also a kickback that comes with the idea of what they call administrative costs. It's fantasy, Greg. The administrative costs are total fantasy. And they say, this year we spent $100 million in administrative costs. We want that back. And when they take a look at what the administrative costs are, all the administrative costs are is that entity deciding who's going to get pills, how much they're going to cost, and then who's going to get the kickbacks after that occurs. But I think the frustrating thing to me about this topic is the media has done such a poor job covering it. And you understand why. Because if you turn on your television, every 8 minutes there's a pharmaceutical ad. So they were completely unmotivated to do anything about this. The Congress was unwilling to do anything about it because there was so much money being spread around in Congress. To this day, there is no good side, bad side here. This is not a Republican-Democrat kind of issue. Both parties are putting tons of money in their pocket from the PBMs, so they allow them to exist. And mom and pop, they have to make a decision whether they're going to actually be able to take that pill, whether they have to cut the pill in half, or whether they're going to be able to eat that night or pay their mortgage. So it's become crisis level. And for me, I'm just astounded. The first time any administration has looked at it is this go-around. And I really think they're going to do something about it, to tell you the truth. Mm.
One of the things that is mentioned is that the three largest PBMs now manage 80% of all prescriptions filled in the United States. When we are talking about a PBM, a pharmacy benefit manager, I mean, at a glance, that almost looks like we're talking about a person. But I don't think we're talking about a person. I mean, a given PBM is going to be some sort of firm. And how large a firm or company or organization are we typically talking about?
Well, in the United States, there's 66 of them. But as you pointed out, there's three major organizations. They control actually 99% of the entire drug industry right now.
And with each of them, how large an organization are we talking about? Are we talking about?
You're talking about thousands of employees.
And what do they do? I mean, what do those thousands of employees do?
So a pharmaceutical company that comes out with a new product will submit, here's our product, here's our clinicals, here's how we arrived at what we believe the pricing should be. And then they go through this process where somebody, some team that's assigned to that particular pharmaceutical says, well, okay, we think you should charge 1,500% increase, just absolute gouging. You should charge 1,500% more for this product. And oh, by the way, after we make that decision, pharmaceutical company, you owe us a kickback. Now, there's no rhyme or reason to why they get a kickback. But if that pharmaceutical does not get blessings by the PBM, insurance companies don't pay for it. Copays in the last 15 years have risen every single year. sometimes the neighborhood of 30 to 40% on copays. So this organization, this amorphous thing is the best way I can describe it. It's not like it's not like it's complex analytical. It's not like they need this many people doing all of this. The truth is they've made so much money. They make so much money doing this that there is no limitation on how many they hire, how they go about doing it. And, you know, I think, Greg, the frustrating thing to me is this, is I come back to the media. The reason the media hasn't covered this is because it's not low-hanging fruit. The first time I saw this covered in any meaningful way was the New York Times, and that was only 2 months ago. And they came out with the term middleman. That was right when my book was getting ready to come out. And there's no other way to describe it. In the book, I have a mobster organization. A fellow named Devlin comes from Ireland, and he comes to the United States. And you know what he does? He looks at the pharmaceutical industry, and he says, this is a great way to make money. Why am I taking any risks by selling cocaine or meth or whatever when I can just move into a PBM and I can control as much drugs legally as I want to? If I get caught, there's a fine. Nobody's going to throw me in jail. And in the United States, we don't throw people that are dressed up in Armani suits in jail. You know, it's a disconnect between the Department of Justice and our justice system. So this mobster comes in the United States and says, why don't I get into this business that's no risk? I mean, I can gouge the prices of what I'm selling. I can determine who's going to get the right to have their product sold, who isn't. So he moves into the Wall Street arena, and he says, Wall Street's doing this. I can build a mob organization around it, and I can do it too. And you know what? That parallel is so close to real life that it's almost indescribable.
We're speaking with Mike Papantonio, who is an attorney by day, in a sense a novelist by night. He has a number of novels to his credit, his most recent called The Middleman, a legal thriller. I want to ask why you have chosen to explore some of these themes with the tool of fiction versus nonfiction. Are there ways in which fiction is, in a sense, more helpful to you? I mean, and for the cause that you're espousing, namely to bring this to light?
People get tired of being preached at, Greg. They get tired of expose, you know, nonfiction book, this really happened. And most of the time, people don't even have time to devote to that kind of reading. So what you do is you take every one of my books, all the way to back to tobacco, to the opioids, whatever it is. Those were stories that were completely, utterly accurate, and they were simply put into a fiction story where, you know, somebody can sit at the beach on a weekend and they can read a book and they can be entertained. They can turn pages and say, wow, this is interesting. But when that's all over, they can say, I think I've learned something. I get comments all the time. You know, I went back and Googled this storyline and it was absolutely correct. I Googled to find out. I did my own research. And all of a sudden, I learned something I didn't know. So you're entertaining them on one hand, and then at the same time, they're learning something really meaningful. And I think that's the key to, I think, a good fiction book that also, it's a double-edged, I mean, it accomplishes two things. It educates them, and it entertains them. I think the reason these books sell is because people have a voyeur interest on what happens on the inside. And when they read a book like How Did the Opioid Industry Occur? Why were we allowing 150 people to be killed a day by this product? And why didn't anybody go to prison? And why does the government react to this type of catastrophe the way they do? All of those elements are put in these books. And so they're able to – it's a good story. I mean, this story is a page-turner, I promise you. It's a page-turner. But at the same time, every page you're picking up something. You're hearing, okay, PBM, they increased the price of insulin 1,500%. How did they get away with that? They were getting kickbacks from the manufacturers of insulin. How did they get away with that without being prosecuted? So all of these things are out there in this book, and they're in all of my books. And the point is, obviously, I can't say those things if they're not true. I mean, you know, they're, even though it's a fiction book, you can only go so far with a fiction concept. But they're all the things that I go to court with every day, and then I come home and I'll make a, you know, make notes on a chapter, and I'll create the book around what's actually happening in real time.
Mm. One of the most crucial characters in your book is someone who ends up shifting her attitude and electing to become, in a sense, a whistleblower. And I think that's one of the trickiest matters, is to make somebody like that a believable figure, or where we believe the shift, that it feels authentic. Tell our listeners about this character of Amy Redman and the critical role that she plays.
Right. Amy Redman's family is the owner of the PBM. And she, you know, she's a little bit naive when she starts out. But then she realizes that this character, Devlin, that's come in from Ireland and decided to get into the PBM mobster business, is that there's something wrong with it. So her motivation isn't just that, golly, this is wrong. Her motivation is that her life's a threat. That's certainly high on the list. But the fact that that you can run the pharmaceutical industry in a way that doesn't do this to mom and pop. And she, you know, she looks at that and she says, I have a responsibility. Her father was affected by it. Her father ends up dying because he simply can't get insulin. So there's a lot of motivational aspects to it. And so it's very believable. As a matter of fact, let me put it like this. 40% of the cases that I handle in these projects, whether it's tobacco, opioids, human trafficking, PFAS, 40% of those cases are driven by whistleblowers very similar to Amy, very similar.
Mm.
So that wasn't a stretch at all. I mean, I've run into Amy's every couple of years. I mean, it's a real element of the kind of practice of law that I do.
Right. And, of course, one of the things that drives this particular story is a very personal connection between your main character, Nicholas DeCannabis, and a good friend of his from college who is connected to this company. And I'm sure in real life as well, often it is personal connections that end up driving stories like this.
Oh, absolutely. The opioid case, I had so many friends that had lost children and family members from opioid overdoses. And I was outraged by it. I was the idea that the Department of Justice threw nobody in prison. It was the equivalent of manslaughter, massive manslaughter, Greg, where they had killed all of these people. It was done at the CEO level by seven major pharmaceutical companies, and nobody went to prison. And if that had been a child out on the street corner selling marijuana for 5 ounces of marijuana, he'd be in prison for 2 years. So it's this disparity that drives me. It's this disparity in the justice system that drives me very often. And it did in this case because you see cases. This isn't just fiction. You see mom and pop that has to make a decision. Can they take their medicine, or can they eat that night? And that's how ugly this story is. And nevertheless, you've got Congress sitting on their hands. First time I've heard anything is just within the last few weeks when this administration says, by God, we got to do something about PBM problem. So I'm optimistic. I'll put it like that.
The book, again, is called The Middleman. It's a legal thriller published by Arcade, and the author, Mike Papantonio. Mike Papantonio, it was great to talk with you. Thank you for giving the world this important and thought-provoking book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the podcast version of the program, the real story behind Davy Crockett, with the author of the book David Crockett, The Lion of the West. On Monday, author Fern Schumer Chapman and her book Brothers, Sisters, Strangers, Sibling Estrangement, and The Road to Reconciliation. from WGTD's Arts and Other Events calendar. The local Racine chapter of the AAUW has their gigantic used bookstore open right now. And that is at 1122 West Boulevard in Racine, the lower level of CVS Pharmacy. Check it out. There is an amazing array of books available. Cloudy and seasonal, some off and on sprinkles today, a high of 56. Light rain possible overnight, low of 43. Sunny tomorrow and a high of 53 degrees. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.